Hey everybody, it's Sunny. I am just letting you know that you are listening on the iTunes, etc. feed. It's free, but you should be signed up to Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com, listen there. We've got a great episode up coming up in a couple days here on Spider-Man No Way Home. Bonus episodes that live there forever. You're not going to want to miss Vic talking about Wild Things, etc., etc. So anyway, go to subbeacon.com, sign up, and enjoy live shows instead of this 2 weeks old episode on King Richard. Pretty good episode, but still, you know, you should have listened to it 2 weeks ago. Anyway, see you over there.
I wrote me a 78 page plan for their whole career before they was even born.
Yeah, baby, yeah.
These girls so great. How come I've never heard of them?
They're from Compton.
It's okay. They're just not used to seeing good-looking peoples like us.
She's nervous. Take a step up.
Maybe she ought to take a few more steps up. Just get someplace safe.
I think you might just have the next Michael Jordan.
Oh, no, brother man. I got me the next, too.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis, along with Jonathan V. Last and Sonny Bunch. Just a reminder, the Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com. You will easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and don't forget about the Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. The holidays are upon us. Order now. Gentlemen, how are we? JVL, welcome back.
Thank you, boys. It is excellent to be back. You know, I always... Oh, here's the answer to our question. 11.5%. Or whatever that is.
Did I just call that? I called
you
it.
You did.
Thank you.
Whenever I listen to the show and John Podhoretz is on it, I think to myself, shouldn't John be on our show every week? It's so good when John is on. It's so good. Now, maybe part of that is because it's a rare delicacy, but I don't know, man.
I would say that's a good idea. Except we would also have to bring in Rob Long or Jonah Goldberg to like get him to keep a tighter rein on the conversation,
because I feel like none of us
jumps in and says, John, we gotta move on.
No, it's better this way.
It is a delight. It is a delight to have John on the show.
It's great.
It's like Blinnies and caviar. But if you had Blinnies and caviar all the time, what would that be like? We don't know.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yes. I like asking John. I always have a ton of New York trivia for him.
Yeah, that's the best when he talks about New York stories.
And he always delivers.
Yeah.
There was one last week, we weren't even taping anymore, and I was asking him we were talking about fashion, and I asked him if he ever went to Fred the Furrier, and he did once.
Oh.
Fred the Furrier.
Okay. I still don't understand that reference. It sounds like something
for the Wild
Things.
It was a guy, and he'd say, I'm Fred the Furrier, and it was about going, you know, when people wore fur coats.
Once upon a time,
like crazy
fur coats
Larry.
Were such a thing that there were TV commercials for furriers.
For coming to affordable, Antonovich and Fred the Furrier.
It's like Maury's wigs.
Yes, don't Maury's wigs don't come off.
My aunt still has a fur coat, a big expensive fur coat.
Like a real fur coat.
It is delivered to her by the furrier around this time every year. And then at the end of winter, the furrier comes and picks it back up and takes it for the special fur coat storage.
Yes, or something. Fur coat storage.
But it's like concierge
service. The freezer in Goodfellas.
For the, Yeah, it's real. So anyway, I'm great. I don't really want to talk too much because I have so much tennis talk I want us to do. So let's just go right to you boys. How are you fellas doing?
Sonny, what's going on?
Not a whole lot on my end. It's the end of the year, which means it's award season for movies, which means I've just been watching like two movies a day.
Yeah. Well, there've been so many good movies this year.
They all come out in the
The answer is Nomadland.
Like,
I hope you voted
weeks.
For Nomadland.
The answer is Pig. Sonny's going to every list he's going to say that Pig is the best movie of 2020.
Number one option.
What is that
you
voice?
Pig.
What is that voice change? That sounded like
you
mockery.
Liked,
that sounded
liked,
like mockery.
You liked
I didn't
Pig.
See Pig. I didn't see Pig because I couldn't get to see it. We did a show where I did something else because I couldn't find Pig in a
that's
theater.
That's right. It wasn't. You haven't even seen Pig then. You haven't even seen the best movie of the year.
A movie about foodies.
We should do another episode about Pig. It's on Hulu now. You can watch it.
Yes.
I rewatched it again this week in glorious high definition.
For the ninth time?
For only the second time. And it's very, very good. It's very good. Number one movie of the year so far. I still need to see Licorice Pizza, the new Paul Thomas Anderson joint.
Will that ever be made widely available, or am I going to have to travel?
It's already gone. We talk about this in box office talk, but it's doing very well in its limited run, and they are like, it's not supposed to go wide until Christmas.
Is Licorice Pizza the first movie ever made in which the leads look like real people?
Yes. Same observation.
The leads don't look like the type of people you see on movie screens.
It looks like people you might have actually known in the 70s.
Yes!
Which tells you something. And I don't know how many times you've watched the trailer. I've watched it a couple times, and every time I'm just like transfixed by that idea. It's so weird.
Yeah, the trailer's 2 minutes, 26 seconds long, and by 1 minute, 45, Victorino, you're sitting there going, well, I don't know, well, maybe she's okay.
I don't know. Oh, yeah, no, you start off the trailer being like, what? Hard pass, and then, okay, and then by the end,
you see her with Sean Penn, and you're like, she's good enough for Sean Penn.
At first, I thought it was Jeremy Renner, and then I said, oh, no, it's Sean Penn.
Did we do an episode on Inherent Vice?
No, what
is that?
Was
that before the show started? It might have been before the show started.
No, I think we just never got to Inherent Vice. It's based on a book, Vic. You wouldn't be into it.
Pass.
Yeah, it's like, imagine The Big Lebowski, but immensely more complex
funny,
more open at the end, more open-ended than The Big Lebowski. I don't think you would care for it. I would like to get maybe we could do a bonus episode on that. I think it's a good quadrant movie.
I would do that.
Kind of.
No, it's long.
Well, it's long and it's complicated, but it does have violence. And Vic's favorite quadrant comes in quite nicely.
I think JVL and I are we have enough time for one.
We'll just do another wild film. You know what? I think every bonus episode for the next year is going to be about wild things.
Yes. We could do that. And again,
we'll just watch that once a week for the next 52 weeks.
And again, it's going to be, this is going to be a great episode, but you have to subscribe. You have to subscribe.
Well, you have to subscribe because if we're going to get canceled. Mm-hmm. For any episode, it's going to be this one, and I demand that people pay for the privilege to cancel us.
That's right. You know, because I do enjoy getting these wonderful tweets by people who are just now catching up to old episodes, which means they're listening on iTunes. Come on, man.
Okay. Come on, Sonny.
All right. So how are you, Sonny? What's going on, buddy?
I'm fine. I rewatched. I talk about watching all these great award season movies, but last night I rewatched Matrix Revolutions, and that movie is still. I don't hate it, but it is a mess. It doesn't change the fact that I'm very excited for Resurrections, the Matrix Resurrections.
Are you serious?
I'm so serious, you guys. I am so excited for this movie. I didn't think it would be possible for me to be excited for a new Matrix movie. I thought the joy had fled.
Question.
Yes.
Has the Wachowski, because it is just one Wachowski, right?
Yes, this is just Lana, I believe, Wachowski.
Has the Wachowski figured out that nobody cares unless we're inside the Matrix? Well, because the big problem with the second and third movies is that they take place increasingly outside the Matrix, and we, the audience, don't give a shit about that.
Well, so, rewatching the Revolutions last night, the thing I realized as I was watching it is that it didn't just largely take place outside of the Matrix. And, like, you could make a case that some of the Zion stuff is interesting, the dock fight, whatever. But the big problem with it is that Neo isn't in the movie for like half the running time.
Yes.
For like half the movie, he's just not in it. Like there's almost all of the big action set pieces until the final one in the Matrix, which looks terrible, which looked bad at the time. It didn't look great at the time, but it looks awful now. Just like a terribly animated cartoon. But the problem with the movie is that like for the whole opening, Neo is in that train station, right? He's not really doing anything. So there's the big fight out in the leather club, and then there's the trip to Zion, right? And like again, for like an hour of the film, he's just not in it. And the only reason the Matrix is interesting is because we want to see what happens to Neo and with his relationship to Trinity. That's like the heart of the movie. And I think, judging from the trailers, that Lana Wachowski has figured that out and that this is going to be what Resurrections is actually about.
I don't think we really care about the shipping between Neo and Trinity. Like, that's nice. What we really care about is, what is the Matrix? That's what we care about. And we need to find out what the Matrix is from within the Matrix, because the outside the Matrix stuff is normal, and we have seen the outside the Matrix stuff 100 times in movies.
Yeah.
The in Matrix is the stuff we haven't seen before. That's where we as the audience want to spend our time.
I only saw the first Matrix, which plot.
That's not true. You and I saw the second one together.
No, that's not true at all, JVL. I did not see the second and the third one. But you know why? Because you told me don't see it. And so I didn't.
I may have done that.
Yeah, you were describing to me like the two guys with the white hair and the whole thing, and you know,
the Merovingian.
Yeah. So
I gotta say, I went to watch.
I don't feel like I missed anything.
I went to watch the first Matrix with Flash a couple months ago, thinking like, oh, it's gonna blow his mind. After 20 minutes, he looked at me. He said, "I'm out. This is lame."
Had things started going within 20 minutes though, like the revelation of the, or just was it too slow of a.
We were not even to the red pill, blue pill. And he was like, this is beat. I'm out of here.
Oh.
And I just thought to myself, man, the new generation, not into it.
Well, kids are trash, so.
You know, look, if it's not TikTok, he doesn't want any part of it.
Well, I mean, it's destroying their attention span. If you can't follow the Matrix. My son
watched it with my dad, but then again, my dad also showed him Pan's Labyrinth. That was that was when they were really small.
I'm like, How old?
He was four at the time. He was probably like 10. I said, "Why did you do that?" "Oh, I thought it was fine." He said, "Anyway."
I mean, I guess it's
it's terrible.
That has some pretty terrifying moments for children. The pale man.
Yeah, no, that the guy gets shot through the face, I think. And
yeah, and the fascist who gets, yeah, but that was okay because he's a fascist. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
you know, yeah, it's sure. Action. It's shoot fantasy. Fascist. It's fantasy.
Okay. Anyway, I'm excited for Matrix Resurrections. That's what it comes down
That's
to.
That's what you're.
I've talked myself into it.
Victorina, how are you, buddy?
I am.
Been a long time since I've seen you.
Yes, I'm hanging in there, busy. I do have a major announcement, which is not counting books that I have to read, work-related, but in terms of books for pleasure, I just finished another one.
What?
Yes, because my son was reading it, so we were reading it with him.
It's Johnny Tremaine.
It's called
Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
No, oh, that's too complicated. Lion, the Witch, forget, I'm not even up to that level yet. The Iliad. Written by Homer, no last name, just Homer.
Simpson?
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. And I have to say, because I didn't read that in school. We did not read that in school. And I have to say that if you did a book quadrant, it would have been an A++++ on the violence. I was really surprised. The description of violence, at least in this particular translation, was very vivid.
Yeah.
Duration is it's long.
It does great on the sex though with Patroclus.
Okay, well that's the thing. All right, I think like I imagine that there's lots of things going on there. You know, particularly what the Greeks are wearing and not wearing, and Achilles. It's unspoken, but Achilles.
He's only angry because Patroclus used to hold his armor so well.
That's right.
They're just bros.
He loved how much Patroclus took care of him, and. And then he sits out the. And I guess
you're the new chicken licker.
Save that for the bonus episode. But that was really interesting, and it was very weird because they do a funeral games to celebrate for Patroclus's funeral at the end, which is weird. Also, Achilles does not die at the end of the book. I thought he did because I saw the movie. And Achilles, you see, Brad Pitt, he dies in Troy. And in the Iliad, it's off scene. His death is predicted. It's predicted, but you don't actually get there. It's very interesting. So,
wait, how does the version you read end?
With let's see, Hector's body is returned.
I think Achilles dies in the Aeneid, right? Isn't that?
Yeah, there's probably listeners screaming at us right now.
I can't
Vic
remember.
Vic is like, I don't know what that is.
I don't know. Don't spoil it. There's a sequel? There's a sequel?
It's funny. I, I have not. I'm very rusty on my classics because it's been 20 years. But I think
Susan Crystal's head has exploded.
She's listening. It's so embarrassing. There is something else called The Odyssey. I'm going to check that out. Okay. Other than that, but it's been so busy. Have you guys gotten around to doing any Christmas decorations yet?
Yeah, we paid somebody to come put lights up.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's that time of the year, Sonny.
That's how they do it out in Tejas.
It's that time of the year where the professionals come in to do all the lights. Do you give them the lights to do, or they just do it?
Yeah, we have to buy the lights. We buy the lights, and then they like put them up around the trees and stuff.
So that's already up for you. That's very nice.
I stuck my three lasers out in the front lawn, and they are shining on the house. It looks great. The entire setup was done in 5 minutes.
Very nice. And you just paid yourself. And Kate set up the lights in our house.
Oh, good.
Yeah, she did. Thank God.
Did you have her up on the roof?
A professional. I had a professional. Her. I paid her.
Sorry.
Anyway, but you know what I was thinking?
Her brother listens to this show.
It's true. I'm kidding. I didn't pay her. But I was thinking, you know what I should do? My mother used to have, you know, she was big on the Christmas village. She had a big, It started small with just a couple things, and then it began to grow, and it's probably somewhere in storage. But I was thinking about that. If I had room, I'd light it up. It would be a magical village. And speaking of magical villages, over the weekend, Encanto was at the top of the box office with 13.1 million, followed by...
Very nicely done.
Oh, thank you. I assume Golf that's clap. What it is. I assume
no,
that's
it's,
what
it's
it
a magical
is
house. It's not a magical village.
It's what?
But you're close enough. It's a magical house. The house is magic, not the village,
so
but close enough.
I saw the trailer and I was like, this is as much as I'm going to see. That was in first place with 13.
Next week, we're doing Encanto.
Yeah, followed by Ghostbusters Afterlife with 10.4. And in third place was House of Gucci with 7 million. Gentlemen, box office thoughts.
Well, you mentioned Licorice Pizza, and Licorice Pizza is doing like pre-pandemic per screen numbers. It's, you know, it's grossing $50,000 per screen or whatever, which is very good. To the extent that I am a little bit surprised that they did not rush out to get ahead of Spider-Man No Way Home. I'm a little, because there was nothing in theaters last weekend, really. And there's not really a ton in theaters this weekend except for West Side Story. So I don't know. It feels like a missed opportunity. But the audience
that's going to see West Side Story is exactly the audience who might see Licorice Pizza.
I'm not 100% sure that's true. I think
no one in America under the age of 35 is going to see Licorice Pizza.
I think that's actually wrong. I mean, I think Paul Thomas. See, I would say it's more likely that nobody under the age of 55 is going to go see West Side Story.
Also possibly true.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson has enough cachet with like the young, you know, kind of filmy. And I don't know, but I don't know. We'll see.
Theater kids are going to go see West Side Story, though. I mean,
theater kids are going to go see Tick, Tick, Boom. That's big with the theater kids. The
what?
Andrew Garfield, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yes.
It's on Netflix now, actually. They don't have to go see it. I don't have a ton of box office thoughts because everything is just kind of in a holding pattern until No Way Home drops in 2 weeks.
How did King Richard
and
do?
King Richard, I think King Richard has grossed less than $20 million.
I forgot that was in theaters.
King Richard is like all of the HBO Max movies in that there are a handful of big event pictures that have done okay. Basically, Godzilla and Kong vs. Godzilla, or I'm sorry, Kong vs. Godzilla and Dune are like the two that have done okay. And by okay, I mean they broke $100 million domestically just barely. And everything else, Cry Macho, King Richard, The Little Things, et cetera, all of those movies have grossed like $15 to $25 million. They just don't, they die because people will stay home and watch them.
How does the Ghostbusters hold So what did it do? Because I missed all of this. So.
It was okay. The second weekend hold was, I think it dropped 45%, and then I think it dropped another 50% this weekend.
That's really good for pandemic time, isn't it?
It's pretty solid. I mean, it's at about 100. It's a little over 100 million right now, 102 million, something like that. It'll probably get to 125 or so. It'll outgross 2016 Ghostbusters domestically, at least, and it will, you know, considering it had half of the budget, that has to be considered a big win for Sony.
Yeah.
But it's not an enormous blockbuster. It's not gonna you know, get up to $200-300 million, which is what
how's the Turtles doing now? It's about 4 million, I think. It was still on the top five, but
how is what doing?
Eternals.
Eternals is still the top five. It was at 157 million or something like that last I checked, which
that's amazing.
It might get
more higher than it deserves. Is that what you're saying, JVL? Yes. Okay.
But it also dropped pretty sharply. I mean, the opening weekend was what, 70 million, something like that. It's not going to do a multiple of three.
Such a terrible movie.
I don't know.
JVL, you're a Paul Thomas Anderson guy. Are you excited for Licorice Pizza or no? I always feel like maybe there was a time where you would have been more excited. I don't get the sense right now that you.
Yeah, I was early on Paul Thomas Anderson back when I was in my LA phase. Mm-hmm.
You were a big Hard Eight fan.
I was a big Hard Eight fan, huge Boogie Nights fan. Yeah. I remember hanging out with our friend Jackie.
Oh, yeah.
And one of Jackie's very close friends out in Studio City one night. And it was, you know, it's like 3 a.m. We're at a diner. And this girl has just read the screenplay for Magnolia.
Oh.
Because they're all friends with PTA. Because, if you're a Studio City kid of a certain age, you just grew up with them. Oh, and was like, this movie's going to blow your mind. What? I love him. I think he's probably one of the, if not one of the great filmmaking talents of his generation in America. And yet his stuff hasn't really spoken to me in a while. That's a me problem, not a him problem, I'm sure. It's, you know, I'm older and, I don't know.
Did we, I can't remember if we talked about Phantom Thread.
We did. I did not love it. But again, this is a me problem, I'm sure, not a him problem.
Man.
Okay.
I bet you'll love this. I feel like this is...
It feels like Almost Famous meets Boogie Nights, at which point Vic and I are in.
Yes, and sometimes you're watching the trailer and I'm getting confused, and I'm forgetting who's the director because it feels like it could be somebody else's movie. You know,
It could be Cameron Crowe.
It could be Cameron Crowe. It could be Cameron Crowe somehow. Throw him into the mix there or something. Now, this week, of course, we are talking about King Richard.
King Richard.
We
wanted to wait until JVL came
back
to talk.
Right.
King Richard.
A court, my kingdom for a court. Oh, thank you. On HBO Max.
I don't get it.
Sonny, how about a big boy review?
King Richard stars the Fresh Prince himself, Will Smith. He is playing Richard Williams, father of the famous Serena and Venus Williams tennis stars. This is essentially the origin story of how Serena and Venus got to be so good. And spoiler alert, it's because their dad, this crazy person, making them play tennis out on the courts, keeping them away from
the
gangs. you know, this is a fairly standard Oscar Beatty biopic type movie about a misunderstood genius who, is a little rough around the edges and has some quirks that Will Smith can really sink his teeth into and turn out an Oscar caliber performance where he's doing a lot of acting. At the end of the day, the hard work and the perseverance pays off with a loss to Arantxa Sanchez Vicario, but an enormous endorsement deal from Nike. So it all worked out.
Reebok?
Reebok. Thank you, Reebok. Not Nike. Unrelated, off topic slightly, but Arantxa Sanchez Vicario, my absolute favorite tennis name, even more so than Anna Kournikova, which was another great tennis name.
Did you just like
saying
Arantxa? Arantxa with an X.
Arantxa. Arantxa Sanchez Vicario. I love it.
The flukiest French Open of all time was the year that she and Michael Chang won the French Open at the same time.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Two kids.
It was like 91, 89, 90. When was that?
Yeah, something like that.
Anyway. Anyway, I want to talk about the tennis stuff, and we'll get to that in a second. As a movie qua movie, it's fine. It's too long. It's like it's 140 minutes, so it's a little bit too long. Again, it is very Oscar Beatty biopic, paint by numbers. It does, however, have one of the weirdest scenes I've ever seen in a movie of this sort, and it comes, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 minutes into it. The girls who, you know, grow up in Compton, so it's, you know, gangbangers everywhere, right? And there's, you know, race problems. But they're playing tennis on the court, and all the Williams girls are there, including, you know, the ones who don't play tennis. And this gangbanger is, like, hitting on one of his older daughters, like, hey, come here, baby, let's, you know, suck my dick sister, or whatever, like, whatever. And Richard Williams is like, I told you, you gotta leave these girls alone. These girls are not your girl. You gotta leave them alone. And so this gangbanger stomps shit out of him, beats him badly in front of his kids, pistol whips him, puts a gun to his head, is like, I'm gonna
smoke
you're not
you?
Worth it. You're not worth it, fool. Mm-hmm. And walks away. And like the next scene is Richard Williams driving the streets of Compton trying to find the guy, and he does.
He pulls out his work gun
and he's walking across the street to, you know, take care of this guy who is threatening him and his daughters, until he is miraculously, like an angel, came down from heaven, killed right in front of Richard Williams.
An angel of death.
Like God has intervened and said, no, Richard Williams, you are not the one who is meant to end this fool's life. This is my job to do.
The drive-by.
And then later, the gang comes by the tennis court and is like, we just want you to know that we're with you, Venus and Serena Williams.
You know what you're doing.
It is the most mind-boggling thing I've
ever
seen
in a
movie of
this
sort.
Was it the guy who killed the guy who said that?
No. It was the guy's own friends, right? I'm pretty sure it's the same car. It's the same guys. It's like the four. There were five guys.
That's right.
Now there are four guys, but like. Yeah. They're coming to the courts. They're like, we believe in you, Richard and Venus and Serena. You're gonna change the world. And it's just like, I have never seen anything like this in an inspirational biopic. Well, this guy got murdered, and that's good for everyone involved.
Truth.
It's just a big win.
Well, you don't study truth to stranger than fiction.
It's just a big win for the entire world, because if Richard Williams had killed that guy, he would have gone to jail. Venus and Serena never would have gotten onto the pro tour. You know, they would never have been able to
derailed.
Do all these things. But thank God the angel came down and smoked that fool right in front of everyone. So anyway, the movie's fine. I have no objections to it. I didn't love it, but it was entertainingly acted. Will Smith is again doing a lot of acting as Richard Williams.
A lot of acting.
I thought the other thing that I will say, again as a movie qua movie, is that the tennis stuff in it looks like people who could actually play tennis were playing tennis.
Oh, I have questions.
Which is not always the case.
Yeah,
I thought the juniors in particular were very, very good. The guys playing Pete Sampras and John McEnroe, I was like, okay, luckily we didn't spend a lot of time with them because I probably would have gotten angry. But the junior stuff was all very good. These kids look like they actually play tennis and belonged on a court, which is no small thing in a movie of this sort.
The best tennis I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah. I think that's a fair...
You're saying this movie? Yes. Okay,
yes. Okay. Representations of tennis.
Okay,
it's a question. Point and Wimbledon are our only comparisons, but this is far and away the best.
Oh, Match Point. Yes.
Or Strangers on a Train.
What was that tennis movie with that Woody Harrelson one with Scarlett Johansson? Isn't that
That's Match Point.
Was it
yes.
Match Point? Yeah.
That did very well. <on the quadrants. laughs> That's all I'm gonna say, you know, on and off the court, on and off. Okay, JVL. Just go.
You know, the whole thing made me vaguely angry.
In what way?
So it isn't a whitewash exactly of Richard Williams, because they, towards two-thirds of the way through, we get a scene in the kitchen of the Florida house between Orosine and Richard, where she basically says, everything is about you, and you're the one taking credit for everything, and it's as if the rest of us are just here along for the ride, and the only reason I'm sticking this out with you is for the girls. Mm-hmm. And that is the moment, the only real moment of honesty about who and what he is, because he's a weird character in that he's not a monster. The tennis world is filled with parents who are actual monsters. Stefano Capriati, Agassi's dad, Mary Pierce's dad, right? Richard Williams is not at that level. He's also not beneficent. And the big tell in all of this is that what people who are watching the movie can't understand, unless you're like deep into tennis lore, is that the movie plays this trick in order to make him seem like not a monster. And the trick is that we begin this movie with Venus being 11 or 12 years old and Serena being 8 or 9 years old. And we are in Compton. They have not been discovered. He is working them out on the courts. They're out playing in the rain. It's tough love. It looks a little crazy. But on the other hand, you know, like they're 11 and 9 year olds, right? In reality, that period of their life was taking place when the girls were 4 and 2. By ages 11 and 9, the two of them were being written about in the New York Times. Yeah. Like all that stuff about, like, you know, down at the Rick Machi Academy in Florida, mm-hmm. they were down to the Machi Academy by the time they were, like, you know, 10 years old. They were discovered when Venus was 7. All the stuff, this nonsense about how he wasn't going to let him play juniors.
Yes.
Okay, so Venus played juniors, and she was 63-0 on the USTA junior circuit, okay? And he pulled him out of juniors by the time she was 11. Now, I think that turns out to have been a pretty good idea. But again, she had dominated the junior circuit. There wasn't anything for her to do on it. Serena started playing juniors at 4.5. She played her first juniors tourney at the age of 4.5. And over the next 6 years, she won 46 of the 49 tournaments she played in. And then she was pulled out of USTA junior competition at age 10. So when you look at it with those ages on it, then that Richard Williams stuff looks a lot less quirky and a lot more insane, right? So all of this, yeah. Like, you know, he had these two, he had Michael Jordan, and he was going around begging people to take a chance on them. But they were already fully formed tennis players by the movie's version of this, yes. Right? In reality, that stuff is happening when the girls are like 4 and 2 years old.
And you can imagine the skepticism.
And by the time they are discovered at age 7, because Paul Cohen, who is the guy who sees, you know, Richard Williams in the movie, barges in while he is working out Pete Sampras and mm-hmm. John McEnroe.
Yeah.
Paul Cohen sees them when Venus is 7 years old, and he immediately flips his lid and was like, this girl could be the greatest female tennis player of all time.
Played by the great Tony Goldwyn.
Yeah. And the scene where they, you know, the girls hit with Pete Sampras, again, this happens when the girls are like 7 years old. That's what's so the idea that, like, nobody was recognizing his genius, again, not true. Mm-hmm. I was a high school senior in New Jersey, pre-internet, and I knew by the time she was 12 years old about Venus Williams. Mm-hmm. And I knew that her little sister, who was a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old, mm-hmm. was supposed to be even better. This isn't the case that, like, they were these hidden geniuses that nobody believed in. They were practically Tiger Woods, right? Yeah. In the sense that Tiger Woods was on The Tonight Show when he was, like, 5 years old, bouncing golf balls and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's how good they were and how early it was all apparent. And so the movie shifts all that time purely in order to make Richard not look like an insane person.
Was it accurate that Richard did think, that the original chosen was Venus, but that he always knew that Serena was going to be even bigger?
I mean, you know, who knows what he ever thought? I mean, what he told people was that what he told people was that he knew they were going to be great before they were even born. Mm-hmm. And then, again, the movie is stacking the deck to make him look like a misunderstood genius. Except you have to understand, for every Richard Williams, there are 10,000 crazy parents who run around at age four saying that their children are going to be, who are wrong.
Trying to convince Vic Braden or Paul Cohen or whoever that
Richard Williams was genius. It's just like he's the one guy who happened to be right in the insane claims he was making because of the genetics, right? This is, you know, he had built these, you know, perfect tennis players. And this bugs me a little bit, primarily because I am an enormous partisan of Venus Williams. I fucking love Venus. And I have
more
always
than Serena?
Believed, way more than Serena. I mean, for like a dozen different reasons. I've always believed that she gets shafted. You know, the genius is always on everybody else, right? You know, Serena's better, and Richard is the mad scientist who created them and all this. And Venus is this, like, unbelievably sweet kid who did something unbelievable. It was way harder for her to be the oldest, who's, you know, the financial situation of the family was riding on her the whole time. She had a much, much harder part in it. And was just, you know, by all accounts, much nicer person. A very sweet kid. A beautiful game. I mean, her game is beautiful to watch and always was. Serena's is much more just, dominating power, which is interesting and exceptional, but isn't as pretty to watch as Venus, right? Venus playing at her top was always more aesthetically pleasing than Serena playing at her best.
And did the whole Williams family really live in the...
Yeah, they all went to Montreux, so the whole family. And Rich again, Macy. All of that happens by like age 10 for Venus. They're all in Florida out of Compton by then. And here's the other... Yeah, I'm just talking too much. I'm sorry. It's because
This is good. This is your thing.
You know, it's like a podcast with three tennis nerds on it talking about this movie that nobody in America has seen. But the other thing...
I like the reference to Tommy Ho.
there are all sorts of funny stories about when the girls were at the Machi Academy. And... I think that Richard's one stroke of genius really was keeping them out of juniors after age 11. I think that was very smart and good for them long-term development. I mean, for one thing, why let the rest of the tennis world catch up to them that early? Right? I mean, they were playing a different kind of game. They're very important, the Williams girls, just in the development of women's tennis. They're a handful of women over the course of the years who revolutionized the game. The Williams girls are two of them. It did, however, stunt their growth a little bit, not playing matches like this, right? So Venus goes pro at 14. She doesn't win her first major for 6 years. She's on the tour for 6 years before she wins a major. Now, again, she has longevity, and it does pay off in the end, but it isn't like that this was a free no-brainer, right? There were a lot of people for those first 6 years who thought, you know, she hasn't learned yet how to put together points, to put together games, to put together tournaments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because she was clearly the most talented tennis player from the moment, you know, on the circuit from the minute she walked on the court. So in ways that much less gifted players like Martina Hingis won a lot of slams very early because she had played the match stuff. Now, again, this is not to say that Richard Williams was either wrong or right, but that it wasn't a slam dunk. You know, this idea to like his great insight to pull them from the juniors, it's not like it came with no cost. It did have a cost to it.
Right.
He wasn't immediately vindicated.
Well, I want the thing I remember as somebody who didn't really like pore over, you know, news about juniors and stuff was Richard Williams being on TV all the time. Like who's the crazy dad in the NBA the last couple of years?
Ball.
Like that guy, but 20 years ago, just like always on TV, always talking up himself and the kids, and like being like, you know, I got so many different jobs, I don't even know if I want to be, you know, coaching their tennis game. Yeah, you know, like that is the thing that I remember the most, and this movie hints at that a little bit, but does not really, I think, drill down into like just how much credit he was taking for these kids
also,
at the time.
Orosine divorced him.
Yeah. They don't mention that. They don't mention that in the epilogue.
Not mention the epilogue. That Tunde is killed in a very tragic way. Right. So the older sister Tunde.
Wait, I didn't know that.
So Tunde is killed in 2003.
She was Richard's daughter from a previous marriage.
No, she was Orsine's daughter from a previous marriage.
Okay.
And this is very tragic. So she's in Compton. She and her boyfriend are like standing. She's like standing outside their SUV talking after dinner, I think it was, and they get shot by a bunch of Crips who mistook them for members of another gang.
Oh,
just one of these senseless, horrible things. I was surprised the movie didn't talk because Tunde's death is a huge moment in Venus and Serena's lives and a huge influence in everything about them.
I'm really surprised, and there's no mention of it at the end either or anything.
Well, they're foreshadowing it over and over, and so I thought, okay, well, we're going to talk about this.
They said, she's going to stay there. He even says, because the whole family's moving, but Tunde's going to stay.
And Tunde was, she's a valedictorian. She was involved in there. She was a manager, right? She was part of the Williams team. Mm-hmm. And she's a good kid, nice lady.
Wow.
I was bugged by that aspect of it, this idea that Richard Williams takes credit for the genius of Venus. I mean, he gets credit for pushing her into tennis early, but she's the one who's out there doing it. She's the one out there on the court.
Right, right.
Do you have an issue with this? So, I mean, like this is like a legit question to ask is you have a movie that is about the two, arguably the two best female tennis players of all time. Certainly like the best in Serena and, one of the top 5 or 10 in Venus. And it's all about their dad. I mean, it's all about, somebody else. Like is he worthy of this sort of thing? Or can you even make a movie about Venus and Serena and have it be dramatic because of their early success and then, later dominance?
It's hard to do a movie about them when they're kids because kids are such ciphers. Who knows what the girl who plays Venus is. I've never seen her before. Yeah.
She's great.
She's great. She even walks like Venus. Like she has the walk down, the physicality, the smut, the sweetness. She just, it's a fabulous performance. I loved it. Vic, when we were kids, and you thought about like Boris Becker winning Wimbledon at 16 or Jenny Capriati winning at 13. It didn't seem like such a big deal. You're like, well, that's just what happened.
That's what they're right. They're kids,
now that you have a 13-year-old in your house, you know how young 13 really is.
Yeah, they're kids. It's insane to think that. And that you would be the parent over somebody who's winning a national championship at that age is really quite remarkable. I thought they were very unfair to Jennifer Capriati. She didn't have such a bad end. I mean, was that real? What happened to her?
Yes.
I'm kidding. Yeah. I'm kidding.
But she came back. I mean, she got her life.
Did she? Yeah. What happened to her after? Rick Machi, really, because the whole thing is he does not. Richard Williams does not want his daughters to become like Capriati. And I do remember the whole Florida and the drugs. Yes.
Can we interrupt briefly to get a quadrants?
Oh, movie qua movie. Keep this in mind.
Yeah, movie qua movie.
Well, the plot is an A. It's pretty straightforward.
You know how it ends.
The dad did it. Okay, we know how it ends. Although, duration is a D. I thought it was going to be enough because I thought, man, we're only at this first tournament. Does it end at Wimbledon? You know what I mean? Because we got a lot more tournaments to go. So, no, duration's a D. Action and violence. Action, I gave it a B+ for on-the-court action, which I thought was great. But my question is, is there any CGI for the tennis?
Yes. 100%. And it's all done very
nicely. Because
it's
really nicely done. So I'm staring at it. It's obviously not like Forrest Gump with the ping pong.
How about the Capriati? Now, I don't know if they were, I assuming that was like deepfake technology where they're you know, they're taking Jennifer Capriati's shots from the end. But however they did it, the girl who played Jennifer Capriati or the CGI entity looked amazingly good.
Yes, yes. So that was,
and
that
same,
was
with, so, same with Sanchez Vicario.
Yes. So the that's why I was like, are these actors who are these professional tennis players who could act enough and they happen to be really good tennis players? Or because if you're looking at, for example, obviously the placement of shots and, you know, like the whole, you've been to tennis, you've all been done tennis camps and whatnot or tennis lessons, and the goal of hitting the corner of the box is a big thing if you can do it, get near it, but to actually not. And so, you know, and of course a placement where she's having, you know, Venus is mopping the, you know, mopping the court with the other player, and you know, the cross court action is fantastic. So I was wondering if there was much CGI in that. Okay, and the sex nudity is an F. You're telling me not once they didn't run into Anna Kournikova in the locker room? Come on.
Kournikova's older than they are.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
She was, and Kournikova was a
she's mentioned.
Media
I think
creation.
She's mentioned.
She is mentioned.
She's mentioned.
Yeah,
she's
and mentioned. She never won a tournament. Not a major.
No,
not a major.
No.
Never won,
no,
a,
won
a tournament.
Never won a singles tournament.
She won a. You know what? She did win a tournament right here. That's where she won a tournament.
No, she never won a singles tournament. She did. I think she won a couple of doubles majors.
The most one of the most overrated figures.
Oh, well,
in
of
all
course,
of
no, totally.
Tennis.
She's. I mean, she was an actual media creation. Like,
and you could tell
more cover girl.
If I could just say, you could tell even when she was at her peak of hotness. You could look at her and see the Russian babushka and know exactly what she's going to look like at age 50.
Yeah. Oh,
that face is going to look like Boris Yeltsin at age 50.
How old is she? Come on. That's just, I don't know. I don't know. You remember the story about her and the complaints about her in the hotel room with Enrique Iglesias, and that the complaints because it was so loud coming out, the noises coming out of that room were so loud. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet.
I was in the other room because I had actually made the hole in the wall, and I was like, this is too loud.
So I have a bunch of questions for you guys.
Yes. Yes, JVL.
So tennis has always been a little bit like professional wrestling in that it is a sport which has very real heels and faces in it, right? Yvonne Lendl, Justine Henin, Dimitriev, Muster, Djokovic, these are all heels. And then people like Kim Clijsters and Chris Evert and Pete Sampras and Roger Federer are the baby faces, right? They might as well be Hulk Hogan versus King
Chris Evert versus Navratilova.
Federer did both. I mean, Federer was a heel at first when he was a baby throwing tantrums on the court, and then became a,
and then
he was the rock of
he was the rock
from the nation of domination to you know, the rock.
So Serena
and McEnroe too became a favorite. People hated Mac.
He was a heel. Yeah, he was an absolute heel. But you know, you live long enough, and eventually you become like Ric Flair. And this is what's very interesting to me. So Venus was always a face. Right. Everybody loved Venus. She was just the sweetest kid. You couldn't not root for her. And Serena was more like Ric Flair. She was sometimes a face, sometimes a heel. Mm-hmm. She would flip back and forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, she, you know, there was there are many incidents. You go back in her history. There's the her shouldering the person during the changeover. There's the her defaulting the finals of the U.S. Open because she threatens to harm the lineswoman. I mean, like these.
Oh yeah,
but again, like Ric Flair.
I forgot about that.
Like you get to the end of their career and you're like, well, it's Ric Flair.
Yeah,
you know, he's bigger than. Everybody loves him. Even when he's a heel, everybody loves him. I think that's the place Serena is in. Mm-hmm. But my question for you guys is, for 20 years or so, Venus and Serena were women's tennis. Mm-hmm. Was that ultimately good for women's tennis or bad? Now, I don't want to sound like Wynn Duffy here. Like you remember Wynn Duffy, the character in Justified, who was always like he's the crook. Who was always weirdly fascinated with women's tennis. Like whenever Timothy Oliphant would come into his trailer, he'd be watching women's tennis, and I'd be like, shh, this is a break point. You know, there's fantastic stuff. Was it good for tennis for the Williams sisters to dominate the way they did? Because I feel like here's my thesis. I put it to you boys, and you guys tell me what you think of it. tennis, professional tennis is best when you have parity. And what parity really means in tennis is that you have 10 or 12 players who all believe that they are good enough to win a major on any given day. Mm-hmm. And during the Venus and Serena's time, there really weren't anybody. Nobody really thought they were good enough to win majors, right, if Venus and Serena were playing well. And so what you have was you have 20 years almost where it is Venus and Serena and whoever over, you know, like, mm-hmm, like every semifinal is Venus, Serena, and whoever over, you know, two, mm-hmm, two Eastern European Russian women who, yes, you can't tell who they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this run where a Williams sister won 12 of 17 Wimbledons, you know?
Yeah.
And so what that is you get a whole generation of players who just didn't think they could win majors with the Williams, mm-hmm, in the draw.
So they just...
And then when they stepped away, that's why you didn't have young players winning. No, when the two of them stepped away, we had this dry spell where majors, mm-hmm, were being won, yeah, by journeyman players like Marion, mm-hmm, Bartoli and Francesco Schiavone, who were like 85 years old.
And just for that one moment, and then on to the next.
Yeah, and it's the parallel here is really the men's game with Federer and Nadal, except, mm-hmm, well, it's well, as, so as if, say, as I, if I, Federer and Nadal were brothers.
Yeah, and then that's it.
I'm sorry. So I'll stop. Was it good or bad,
Sonny?
I was going to say it is. I don't know if it was good or bad for the game. I don't really have a way to answer that question, except to say that I think it was bad for the game overall to have that coincide with Federer, Nadal, and then Djokovic. Basically, you had a 15-year stretch where there were like two people on each side, mm-hmm, of the draw who were always going to be dominant. And I think that was bad for the game as a whole, because I stopped watching tennis.
Sure.
I stopped watching tennis, I don't know, 2008, something like that. Yeah. Because I was bored.
Me too.
I didn't really care about it as much anymore. Now, you know, part of that's just getting older and, mm-hmm, you know, not caring as much, but like it was a very real thing where it was like, well, it's going to be probably Serena Williams and either Nadal or Federer, mm-hmm, depending on the surface.
That's right.
Yeah. That's a problem for the game. That's a problem for the game.
Well, you know, the good news is you don't get generational talents like that very often, so it will work itself out. And I, you know what, especially, I will forever love Venus Williams. I loved watching her play. It is, the two of them carried American tennis. They carried United States tennis for a generation all by themselves, and that is no small thing. And whatever their other faults, they refused to be used by outside actors to advance other agendas at every turn, mm-hmm, in their careers. And I think there is something very very admirable about that. I think I've talked about this on the show before. There's a press conference from the Australian Open. Venus is being interviewed, and it is January 20th, 2009. And so Barack Obama has just been inaugurated, mm-hmm, and Venus has won her second round match, the Aussie Open, and she's at the at the post-match press conference, and she's being asked over and over, well, how much does this day mean to you with that great man, Barack Obama, being inaugurated president? And she sort of dances around it, like noncommittally, and they keep asking her, and she finally says, I'm Jehovah's Witness. We don't vote. If other people are happy, then I am really happy for them. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk about tennis, I would love to talk about that.
Right. And a lot of people were not happy with that answer.
But this was, again, tennis is a very progressive sport, right? The establishment in tennis is this idea that it is a rich conservative thing. It is rich, but it's always been a rich progressive, mm-hmm, sport. This is, you know, like going back to the 70s, Billie Jean King. Tennis would have loved to really use the Williams girls to advance all sorts of its
things,
political proclivities. The Williams sisters were just uninterested,
right,
in all of that. And I think, again, I just think it's admirable.
It was interesting when they talk about when Richard Williams is trying to raise the stakes when he's talking to Rich Machi about, you know, whether or not, and he said, oh, I got a call from, you know, he was talking about
Nick Bollettieri camp.
And that got me wondering, to get into those camps, was it just a matter of you had to pay? It wasn't like there was like it was like a broad thing, though. I mean, you didn't have to qualify. It was some of that. Is,
well, I had a guy who went to one of those. I think he went to Bollettieri.
A friend of mine.
Mike Sell. Yeah, Mike Sell went to Bollettieri.
Oh. Wow.
There were tiers of this, right? So there were the kids who were auditioning to get in, and those kids were paying.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And just to say that they
were
they
the people
say, oh,
that
went,
the academies were recruiting to get in. Mm-hmm. And those kids did not have to pay.
Yes, I see.
And it's one of these things where you should, you know, parents should have been sophisticated enough to know that if you have to pay for your child to attend Bollettieri Academy, then your child is not going to be able to make money as a professional tennis player. Mm-hmm. Right. This is
where they want it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Very this is, and there's a moment in that actually at the Machi Academy where he says, Rich Williams says to Machi as they're walking through the first time, he says, oh, that looks like chum. What he means is a bunch of players who are here as students who aren't actually good enough to be, you know, top 100 players. Anyway, before we get out of this, I would say one of my favorite Rick Machi stories of the Williams sisters came from Andy Roddick, who was there at the same time.
Oh, he's mentioned. He's in
the He is mentioned. Yeah, they see his brother,
well, his brother
John.
There. Yeah. His brother.
And he says, you know, his younger brother's even better. I can't wait to get him. And Andy talks about how he was there at the same time as Serena, the same age, I think. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, when we were there, I weighed like 84 pounds. And Serena was already bench pressing dump trucks. Like it just, you know, Serena hit the ball so much harder than he did. And a lot of that is, you know, like, you know, early onset puberty. He was a late puberty guy, but that he was like, you know, even again, that's at age 10 and 11, Andy Roddick, who was at that point already the future of American men's tennis, was watching Serena Williams. And it was obvious that she was possibly the greatest player of all time.
I would say, by the way, speaking of Rich Machi is, anytime John Bernthal is on, I think I'm liking the movie. I don't think there's a movie that I've seen.
He was great in this, wasn't he?
He's very good.
This is how all these coaches talk.
Yeah, yeah, I know. He was very good. He was very
the patter, right?
Yeah, the patter. Yeah, that's exactly right.
There was a lot of tennis coaches have a lot in common with like campaign managers. They have to be great talkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's too bad. You know, it would have been great to have a piece about this movie from like Tom Parada, if you were around.
He passed away.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. It would have been great. Good. that's what I meant by it. I would say the one thing that I found very uncomfortable watching, I thought Will Smith did a very good Richard Williams in terms of sort of the way he looked, the sort of the eyes, very wrinkly and sort of grizzled looking and the hunch. But every time I stared at him, and then later on they showed pictures and the video clips of the actual Richard Williams, I felt like I was looking at myself. Like I feel like
large
I have the same large head and the posture were very, I'm like Asian Richard Williams. It was very disturbing to watch that. I'm pretty much, I feel like I'm his age now and sort of just hunched over and same head size and head shape. The head shape was the same. It was very, very uncomfortable. Okay. Do we have any other thoughts? Anything else on this? Okay. Wonderful. Corrections, shout outs. You have a spirit, JVL. Oh, we were drinking this.
Hardywood Bourbon Barrel GBS Gingerbread Stout. I think maybe I prefer the normal.
It's
gingerbread stout.
He
the
showed
Bourbon
it to
Baron
us.
Is a little bit too much for me, I think.
And I asked what was the proof on it, and I said, and I guessed 11%, and it's 11.5.
It's a little smoky.
Yeah,
whereas
well,
the non one is just
no,
a little crisper.
Just get bourbon at that point. Just go for the bourbon. Okay, yeah. I do have a not really a correction, but an amplification, if you will. Good friend Ian Brody, one of our Canadian listeners, says that Ghostbusters wasn't just quote shot in Canada, but rather at Fort McLeod, Alberta, around the corner from where Legends of the Fall was shot, and not far from the Revenant. Alberta, which I believe is just a little west of Montreal. Okay, that is all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at Sunny Bunch, at Victorina Mattis. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon.
And if you don't show up for this special bonus Wild Things episode, you are missing out.
Come on, you are missing out. Just go to subbeacon.com. We're there. Tell your friends. Until next time. So, you got anything?
I get into crypto a little bit while Shannon was away.
Oh boy.
Speaking
yes,
of wild
not
things.
Really. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
How many NFTs do you own now?
You know, who could say? Three. I own three NFTs now. I think that's a sign that the whole thing is about to actually collapse in on itself, though.
Do you what cryptocurrency are you into? Is it just Ethereum so you can buy the NFTs?
I get a little bit. I'm spread around a little bit. I have a little bit of a Matic, which is the Polygon network crypto. I have a little bit of Ethereum, a little bit of Bitcoin, a little bit of SushiSwap. But with this, I really do believe, though,
that it'll be like 20 different things by the time we're done with this. It's,
this is the moment when the whole thing collapses in on itself like a neutron star.
A little bit of black hole.
That's right. I'm sure
it'll be fine.